As we record this a couple of weeks ago, I wrote something on the Ubuntu Discourse, and I announced my intention to step back from Ubuntu Mate and put out a call to action for, I think I said, passionate Ubuntu contributors to make themselves known to me if they were interested in taking up the reins and carrying the project forward.
What was the motivation behind stepping down and stepping away from it?
I think the crux of it really is I don't have the passion for the project that I once did. So I haven't been putting in the effort in the recent release cycles. The release cycles are 6 months long, and I've been leaning on some of the Ubuntu community flavor contributors who've been picking up some of the slack and keeping things going. And I just got to another point in this release cycle, and I was very aware I hadn't done much work on it. In fact, nothing at all this time round. And I didn't think that was really fair to the users of Ubuntu Mate. And also, I knew I wasn't going to actually do anything about it. And it was time to stop pretending that I was going to get back to it.
I guess listeners to this show won't be surprised to learn that A, Ubuntu, and B, Mate aren't the main technologies that you focus on these days, right?
Yes, indeed. So I've not been using Ubuntu as my regular operating system for some years now. Yes, Nix all the way. And although I did start using Mate on Nix when I first started using Nix OS, that only lasted like a week, and I moved to Elementary as my desktop, and I ran that for I think a year and a half before I switched to, you know, using tiling window managers and Wayland compositors and things. So I haven't really been involved in Mate at all for, you know, some considerable time.
And in terms of handing over the reins, what's the response been like so far? Do you think you've got other people involved who can keep the project moving forwards?
So I was actually quite concerned going into this that nobody would be out there with any interest at all, and that would signal sort of a withering and death of the project. But actually, I was quite pleasantly surprised. So there is an Ubuntu community contributor who's been helping out with the flavors generally, mm-hmm. who has stepped forward and said that they would be interested in keeping things going. I don't know if they have the full intention of like running the whole project or just sort of keeping the essentials ticking over. But then what really surprised me is two of the upstream Mate developers who are well known to me, who I've known for many years, came forward and said they would be interested. So what was interesting there is one of them, Victor, he actually works for Red Hat, and he runs Fedora, and so he runs Mate on Fedora principally. But he uses a lot of the Ubuntu Mate tools that I've created that he maintains in Fedora. So, you know, the Mate tweak and some of these other bits and pieces and the menu systems. So he wanted to take on responsibility for some of those tools because he relies on them. And then one of the other upstream developers who I thought was mostly interested in Debian is very interested in keeping Ubuntu Mate going as well. So between the two of them, they represent sort of people that I know that are administrators for upstream Mate desktop. So they're trusted. They're, you know, this is one of the concerns about stepping away from mm-hmm. a project is who are you handing it too. And you know, it's nice that I don't have to vet these two individuals because I've known them for a long time.
I guess it's one of those things, there's two parts to this. One is like popularity and the favor of one distro and desktop from another waxes and wanes over the years, you know, something super popular and then something fresh and shiny comes along, but there's almost always this undercurrent of users who are passionate, enthusiastic users of the thing no matter what the new shiny is. And there's always the conflict between the two, because those people who are interested in the new shiny will move to the new shiny, but those people who are happy with what they've got will stay there. And keeping all of those people happy are the people who are maintaining all these things. And there's a very small number of enthusiastic technology experts who can keep all these things working. And you are just one example of, you know, the vast number of people who keep all the Linux desktops going. And it's kind of unfair in some ways to expect someone to have to keep hold of something and have to keep maintaining it forever. It's not unreasonable to expect you to move on, right? And expect anyone to move on, just like a user moves on. And I think it's good that you're handing this off to other people. I'm going to ask you a rather brutal question. Do you think you should have done it earlier?
Yeah, I do. I probably should have done it maybe a year and a half ago. That's when I first was aware myself that I wasn't. The fact of the matter is that it was a solved problem. Like, I'd solved the problem of making it. It didn't need to change very much. You have to go through that sort of process every 6 months to make sure you put out a working version every 6 months. But I wasn't interested in doing anything. It kind of worked. And my interest in when I have time to work on stuff, it isn't Mate Desktop anymore. That isn't what ignites the flame inside me of interest and curiosity. So yeah, I should have stepped down sometime sooner, but you know, I am at least doing it now, maybe a little on the late side, but nevertheless, it's 12 years of, you know, my time that I've put into this.
No, I'm not wishing to belittle that at all, because it's a lot of effort. And actually, it's a testament to the fact that it is mostly somewhat self-maintaining. Like, there's not a huge amount of churn in the code base. That some would see that as a good thing.
Sort of the point of it being Mate, isn't it? It's old and it's stable and it does what it always did.
Yeah, it's like one step above XFCE, maybe, but not a huge step above XFCE, if that, in terms of like maintainability and forward progress and all that kind of stuff, right?
I think there's more feature development happening in XFCE. And I think that the big job in Mate for Debian and Ubuntu Mate is uplifting packaging, because we're a version behind and it's a whole lot of packages and the interweave of all of the dependencies and everything. That is the biggest job in maintaining a distribution, is keeping that harmony of packaging and packages and dependencies all balanced and working. It's even more difficult when you're working within the group of the Ubuntu flavors, where there's lots of different desktops sharing a lot of underlying technologies, right, and all wanting to do their own things and not tread on everyone else's toes. So it's quite a delicate little dance we have to do.
But the flip side of that is you have the benefit of the rest of the community who actually do step in and help now and then when needed. So it's like, if there's one core library or framework that's used by a bunch of the flavors, often one of the flavors will step up and do the work and lots of others will consume it. It's not that everyone has to do the same thing over and over again. It's one of you steps up to do it and makes a bit of effort and contributes. And that's the whole point of having this central repository and a community, is you're all working like roughly in the same direction, like an open source free software desktop, but like in your own way, doing things slightly differently, whether it's like the way KDE do things or the way Mate does it or some other, like Cinnamon or whatever. Everyone's got their own take.
Right.
But there's this commons of software that you all work on together. And I think that's a testament to Ubuntu. The way that Ubuntu has done this, I think, is rather good.
And I think there's an important point there, because part of the Ubuntu Mate project isn't just the distribution. And there's a community around it, and there is an Ubuntu Mate discourse. And I think we were among the very first people to deploy a discourse server back when it was a very tricky thing to do. It was quite new and it was fast moving. And we've been running that for 12 years. And I say we, because a friend of mine, Luke, has been majoritively running that for that whole period. It's been astonishing the amount of effort he's put into that. And so that whole commons idea, we have announced that we are going to shutter the Ubuntu Mate discourse. We're going to export it as a static site and host that so it's sort of preserved in aspic. But what we're going to be doing and what we have started doing is signposting the Ubuntu discourse, which has an Ubuntu Mate category, and saying that if you're an Ubuntu Mate user and you've been using the Ubuntu Mate discourse, this is the place you should come to, because not only is it a place where Ubuntu Mate users are, but the wider Ubuntu community of users are there as well. And a bit like the distribution maintainers or the flavor maintainers, the cross-section of Ubuntu users using these different flavors can also help each other as well.
I have been living out my childhood dream of commanding the Starship Voyager in a new game.
Oh, a game. Okay. Interesting. Well,
yeah, no, I'm not for real life.
Well, I saw the title and I just immediately thought the TV series.
Huh. Is this the series with the Ewoks and the Wookiees and all that, or is
no? This is the other one. This is the one with the round gate that they go through and the people with the things in the
Sorry.
No, right. So this is a game called Star Trek Voyager Across the Unknown, which is a new game based on the TV series.
Okay.
So the TV series was on when I was like at school, and that was my first sort of Star Trek that I watched like as it was coming out. So a new game coming out was of interest to me. And something that further piqued my interest was that when the release announcement came out on Steam, it said the game features roguelike elements.
Aha, uh-huh. Well, that's right up your street then.
Perfect. Tick and tick, yes.
Well, I think it's probably arguable about whether the game features roguelike elements, but I won't say that's affected my enjoyment of it too much. It's kind of an amalgam of lots of different genres of game all stuck together around the storyline of the series. So very sort of minimal spoiler introduction to Voyager. It's a Star Trek series, space opera set on a starship, except rather than going around Earth and its neighboring worlds, at the beginning of the series, the ship is thrown across the other side of the galaxy and the series follows its journey back home. And so in the game, you are making that journey back home.
Wow, it's going to be a long game, Mark. Well, I've watched Star Trek Voyager.
This is one of the things I wondered, is how much of it, you know, do you actually have to go all the way back? But it divides the game into sectors, which are mm-hmm. roughly based on either a major episode or a story arc from the game. And there's something right. like 10 or 12 of them that take you from the first episode to the last episode, essentially. And along the way, you encounter events in the game and you can choose how to respond to them based on, you know, your preferences, but also things you've done, people you've recruited, people who've died along the way, which therefore means that a thing they might have done in the series can't happen anymore. There's lots of sort of what ifs and ways that you can change the story that you know from the TV show.
How much of the TV show have you seen? Or do you remember?
I have watched the whole thing several times and remember it quite well.
Oh, okay.
Which and is this a legitimate license, like,
yes,
piece
properly
of property?
Done.
Okay, right.
Yeah, properly done. Even includes some of the original cast as voice actors. So oh, nice. It's not fully voice acted, but in between each sector, it has a log introducing the events, and that a couple of the members of the original cast do those. So that's really nice in terms of the flavour. But yeah, the game that it reminds me of the most overall is Sunless Sea, which I've spoken about before, where you are on a ship on the sea, traveling around various islands, and there's bits of interactive fiction in each place that then, you know, things have a chance of going well or badly, and you can affect those depending on the things you've got or the people who are with you. And it's a similar sort of thing to that, except it's kind of like the second playthrough of that for me, where you already know what the stories are and what some of the choices are going to be and things that you might want to avoid. Because playing this for me, as soon as I see a character, I think, oh, you know, they might not be who they seem, or, you know, they're giving me something now, but something bad's going to happen in a bit, so I might not want to accept it. And then, you know, so it's kind of interesting from that point of view. It kind of has that kind of roguelike replayability, except it's almost as though I've already played it once.
In my mind's eye, I can visualize Star Trek Voyager because I remember it. But in terms of the game, what's your perspective on the game? Do you play a character or is it like a god mode game?
So it's kind of like a resource management colony sim kind of game. So you're kind of god mode. You're in charge of the characters. You recruit. So you start off with some of the crew from the game, and then you can recruit other people as you go along. Some of whom are characters who get picked up throughout the series, but some of whom are like side characters who you can recruit who aren't actually part of the crew in the series and therefore give you other options. But your perspective is partly a sort of side on view of the ship with all the decks like you see on the screens on the series. Right. And then you have to manage the rooms and make sure everything's got power and crew and stuff like that, and make sure you're producing food or you're finding food and keeping everyone happy and alive.
Dilithium. I seem to remember it was always a dilithium crisis. Yes.
Dilithium, tritium, geranium, then the other one. Yes.
I have to say, you're describing the user interface just as I'm watching the trailer video on the Steam store, and oh golly, this looks great. And there's a bit that you're talking about, the side view of the ship, but then there's also lots of, I don't know if they're cut scenes, like spacey style stuff, ships flying around, but also there's like the resource management and having conversations with people. Exactly. And I can see the headshots of the actors and like characters like Neelix and stuff that I recognize. I've never really watched it or never got into it, but boy, oh, howdy doody, I am going to buy this because this looks really good.
Yeah. So, outside of that sort of ship management bit, you're kind of exploring the galaxy. It's kind of a bit like Galactic Civilizations or like Civilization, where you go to worlds and events happen and you have to try and collect resources, or you might get ambushed by another ship. And then there's a proper 3D space battle section, and then there's just sort of like conversation dialogue with portraits and options like interactive fiction. So it's like lots of bits of different genres put together, but each bit of that then affects all the others and what you can do in the others and what your priorities need to be. And it pushes you forward through the game as well, because the idea is the crew will want to get home. They don't just want to sit around collecting resources forever. So it kind of pushes you on through the story and through the sectors. And it's been really good fun. I've done a playthrough so far.
Oh, a complete playthrough?
A complete playthrough.
Oh, wow. Okay. How long did that take?
A while, because I had to... This is the thing. So one of the things that's not so roguelike about it is it doesn't have permadeath. If you die, you can restart at any sector. So, or if you mess up, because you can be, with it being a resource management game, you can completely screw up your resources and end up without, like, you get through a sector, but you're limping along and you can't make it any further. So, but you can just restart the previous sector and then you know what you need to do a bit better. So there were a few sectors which I had to play through two or three times before I was in a good enough state to continue. I probably took 40 hours to get through the whole thing.
Oh, that's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looking at the minimum resources and optimal resources on the Steam page, number one, it only says Windows, so I assume you're running this through Proton.
I assume.
It also has, it says 16 gig of RAM and a 1060 is good enough for minimum requirements and only 10 gig of display. So it doesn't seem like it's not like a massive game by the look of it. So, and it runs okay in Proton, does it?
Yeah, I mean, I just installed it on the Steam Deck and didn't think about it, and it works. I mean, yeah, the graphics aren't going to win any awards. Like the 3D models of the crew that you see, like on the bridge, are a bit hammy. The portraits are honestly a lot better. I think they probably would have done well just having like 2D standees rather than 3D models in some of the cases. It might be that that's just because I'm running it on the Steam Deck, and actually it looks, you know, photorealistic if you run it on something a bit more powerful. But yeah, no, I mean, it's not a massively resource intensive game from that point of view. You can run it on pretty much whatever. The one thing, well, actually, one other thing I should really shout out is the sound design on it is absolutely brilliant, because obviously in the scenes on Star Trek, there's always like little clicks and beeps and stuff that goes around. And as you like interact with the interface, you get really satisfying, just like little beeps and boops as you go over each room and select each menu, which really just brings in the immersion of it. I really like that.
You really need that in sort of a resource management game, because it's not going to lean heavily into the graphics. So having a good soundstage. I read a book around sound design in computer games, and it is such a craft, and it's not a skill I have developed yet. I bought a whole bunch of assets of things like that, those sort of ambient noises of being on board a ship. And I tried to create a simple environment, and it was not, it didn't land or sell the experience at all. I found it very difficult to do.
I'd be the thing that I'd be really interested to hear is if anyone has picked up and played this who hasn't watched Star Trek Voyager, and how it is for them, because obviously the thing that really drew me into it was my like deep love of the show and the opportunity to play through that and, you know, and do things a bit differently, change things that, you know, so they went how I might have done them. But I'm really interested to know how it plays to someone who doesn't have that prior knowledge, who just likes this sort of game. So yeah, Alan, if you go and play this, I'd like to hear, I'd like to see your ship at the end and see how it turned out.
Yeah, I will do that. I have been playing with OpenClaw.
Oh no.
That's that AI automation thingy-majiggy, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of. So I first heard of this back in, I think, November last year. I'll put a link in the show notes to, I think it's a Medium post, which is like a history of the project if you want to know where it came from and, you know, why it became popular and so on. But it was the author of this project, and at the time it was called ClaudeBot, and Claude as in claws like a lobster would have.
Not Claude as in the other AI agent, definitely not.
Yeah, well, more on that in a moment. And it was the author, Peter Steinberger, who actually, he's got an interesting background. He made his millions through a PDF management toolkit or something. And
didn't we all?
And has been, you know, living a good life off of that work he did some years ago. And then came back into tech last year and got bitten by the bug of like AI agentic software development, and basically skipped over the bit where you copy and paste stuff from an AI web page into your IDE and just skipped straight to the, you know, doing it with agents and doing it automatically and having swarms of like processes doing stuff for you, and built this thing, which is, you can think of it as like a personal assistant. And so if you think of in the real world what a personal assistant does, if you're lucky enough to have a PA, is generally you'll ask, you'll be offloading tasks to them. They'll have some autonomy and they'll have some decision-making powers, and they know what you want, right? So if you say, I would like you to book me a holiday in Egypt, they would probably know you want to go with the family. They would probably know the types of hotels you like, the price range you like, the airlines you like to fly on, that kind of thing. So a personal assistant knows a bit about you, knows some of your preferences, and can make some autonomous decisions on your behalf if you tell them that's okay to do. And so if you think of it like that, but in the computing world, where it's a thing that you can talk to, give tasks to, give instructions to, have a conversation with, and it can then go off and do those things for you and then come back to you when they're done, or just get on and do them and you find out later that those things have been done. It's that kind of thing. And when it was discussed in this talk, which happened in our office in London, Peter gave the talk himself and gave a rather compelling demo, which was he was talking to his Claude bot via WhatsApp. He added it as a person in his WhatsApp chat and started talking to it and say, oh, can you do this for me? Could you do that for me? Could you go and research something for me? And he gave the assistant access to lots of things that you probably would feel a bit twitchy doing, probably feel a bit twitchy giving access to a bot. Like, your web browser, all of your email, your calendar, like, you know, your PayPal account, and like all kinds of things that you might think, well, that sounds dangerous. Mm. And sure enough, if you give it unfettered access to lots of things, I'm sure it can be. And since then, since I heard about this back in November last year, it has taken off quite a bit. It's been renamed a couple of times. There's lots of backstory, and the article that we'll link to talks about that. And I'm not so much interested in that and the drama. I'm more interested in how could I use it? Is it useful for me? And does it do anything that I might find helpful in my daily life as an assistant, really?
So this sounds like, given what you said about how it might do lots of things that you wouldn't necessarily trust it to do, this sounds like an excellent use case for something you spoke about recently. Is this in any way related to your decision to create Linkubate?
Well, it's funny you should say that. It was, actually. I thought I would like to be able to confine this thing and run it somewhere and not have to worry about it having full rampant access. And I know some people have, and it's quite entertaining in the things it can do, but I really want to only enable little features bit by bit that I feel happy about. And so, yeah, I installed it inside a LexD container, and I followed some guides. It's not hard to install, but I followed a couple of guides online. And in fact, the thing that like nudged me over the edge was one of my coworkers, Macy, has set it up for herself. And she was describing how she set it up. I think she wrote a blog post, and she's done a couple of GitHub gists that talk through Quick Start and how you get it installed. And I'll link to those in the show notes as well, because they're actually quite helpful. And I installed it inside this container on a server at home. Now, she installed it in a DigitalOcean droplet, which sounds like a good idea as well, like on a remote machine, doesn't have access to all your SSH keys and, you know, everything. And you can add access to it, as in like add plugins, enable plugins, give it API keys and stuff as you feel more comfortable doing that, right? And that's the way I wanted to go. But I didn't really want to spin up yet another machine in the cloud. So I used my good old friend HP micro server. I used my my 8th gen micro server, and yeah, installed it in a container. So what I really wanted to do was have something that I could talk to in a chat app, and I didn't want to use WhatsApp, so I use Telegram a lot. And so I added a plugin so I can talk to it in Telegram. And it's just a one-to-one conversation. It's a bot in Telegram. I can just ask it a question and it will go off and do something and then come back to me and tell me when it's done. But as well as that, I can also give it a task list of things to do that it could do while I'm asleep. And this is the thing that's the most compelling for these things for me, is while I'm asleep, I would really like for something to maybe go and check for any new open issues that appear on some of my repositories, or if there's any like Dependabot pull requests that get created, or, you know, other things that maybe there's a new upstream version of something and my snap is outdated. You know, there's right. all kinds of things that is busy work that I can do I'm quite capable of doing it. And I would only do it while I'm awake, which I think is reasonable. But some people think I do, you know, this stuff in my sleep, but no. I would really like an assistant that could just do some of the busy work that I don't really want to do while I'm asleep. And so that was my goal, is to use those 8 or 4 hours that I sleep every day to do something useful. So that was really the motivation, and to test this stuff out. And I also didn't want to give it access to my GitHub account. I didn't want it to act as me. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to go online and pretend to be me and do pull requests on stuff as me. I want to have control over that. So I created a persona, shall we say. And this is a common thing with OpenClaw. People give them names. Like Macy has called hers Marcus, and his surname is Down, D-O-W-N-E, which if you look at it, it's Marcus Down, Mark Down is his name, which I thought was quite cute. I called mine Mini Love, which is short for minimum lovable product, as in Mini Love, minimum love. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. I'm not very inventive when it comes to names. And I created a Gmail account for them, and I created a separate GitHub account for them so that they could do pull requests on my project and I could see everything they did, because it's in a separate GitHub account and it's only got access to whatever that GitHub account has access to. And so if you could go and have a look at the GitHub account, which I'll link to in the show notes, and it has done a bunch of stuff. It's fixed some of my snaps. It's updated some of them to newer versions of the core libraries. It's bumped a couple of them. It's added some automation to take screenshots of the apps so I know whether they're working as a GitHub automation. And it basically learned how to do this from another repository that I told it to go and look at. And it just added that to all of the graphical applications. So stuff like that, I could do myself, but it did it.
How guided was that change to do the screenshots thing? Did you say that's what you wanted as the outcome, or did it figure it out by mining around in other repositories and thought this is a good idea, I should do that?
I specifically said I'd really like the graphical snaps in my GitHub repo to have a GitHub action that takes screenshots whenever a pull request is done, so I know that those applications continue to work after I land this pull request, right? Mm-hmm. And I did give it the hint. I said, I'm pretty sure the Snapcrafters repo do this. I'm pretty sure that either Discord or Signal Desktop, one of the snaps in the Snapcrafters repo, does this. Go and figure it out, basically. And what it did was create a private repo on its own GitHub account and tested this stuff out. And then once it got it right, it then did a pull request on a couple of mine, And it iterated on it as well. And I had to approve the ability for it to run the GitHub action. I had to, like, you know, mm-hmm. standard GitHub permissions. I had to hit allow and run. And after a while, I was like, actually, this is getting pretty good at doing this. So I actually gave it access to the repository as a contributor, just like you would someone mm-hmm. else, a human who has approved that they could do what they, you know, what you ask. You give them access to run, maybe. And yeah, it then did that for a couple of repositories. I said, yeah, that looks good. Can you roll that out to all the other graphical applications that are snaps in my repo? I didn't list them. I just told it which ones they were, and it went off and did pull requests against all of them. And you can see all those pull requests. I also told it, I really like the readme scribe thing that's on the front page of Martin and my GitHub account. Can you make one of those for yourself so you have a pretty GitHub profile for yourself? And it went, yeah, okay. And it went off and did that as well. So it's, you don't have to give it a ton of guidance. I mean, underneath it is still whichever AI like platform LLM agent you're using. So I've hooked it up to Anthropic's Claude. I've given it an API key for Claude, so it's doing it through that. But you could use ChatGPT, you could use in-house open source LLMs mm-hmm. as well. And a good argument for doing that is, you know, keeping all your data on your own LLMs. But the other part is sometimes the local open source LLMs are a bit slower. But actually, if it's doing it while you're asleep, does it really matter if it's a bit slower? If it takes an hour to do something that an open source, a non-open LLM does in like 10 minutes, who cares if it takes an hour? Because you're asleep anyway. So what does it matter?
That's something I was wondering, actually, is when you say this runs overnight, are the things you're asking it to do things that it takes all night to do? Do you have any kind of metrics of, like, the tasks it does and the amount of time it spends on them? Or is it always doing stuff all the time? Or is it, like, in batches?
So that's a good question. So what you tend to do is, once it's configured, you can tell it to check a location for things to do. And so I created a Git repo, private Git repo in its own org, in which I could put just a list of tasks to do. So if I ever think of something, I could put it in there. That was my goal initially. And then I thought, I'm more likely to just ask it in Telegram. Once I hooked it up to Telegram, it's easier for me to just say, can you do these things? And ask it to make a note of those things in its memory and do them later on. And so that's what I tend to do. I don't tend to, at the moment, I've only had this running like 5 days. I don't tend to have that to-do list that it plows through overnight, but I could. And the reason why is because I just go to Telegram and I say, hey, here's a thing I would really like you to do. And I'd like you to do it across these 10 repositories. And it burns through it really, really fast and does it in minutes. And so often I'm just about to go to bed and I think, oh, it'd be really good if my assistant did this thing overnight. And by the time I'm in bed, it's done it. right? And it doesn't actually take all night to do that. Now, it might take all night if I was using a locally hosted LLM on my rubbish old, you know, NVIDIA GTX 1080 or something. Yes, it might take longer, but it doesn't, because I'm using one of the frontier models that's quite fast. I might switch it and test it with a local model. I have access to local stuff as well. So the short answer is, I don't know, really. It could take longer, and none of the things I've asked it to do take an excessively long time. But when I ask it to do something in Telegram, it says, you know, Mini is typing, and then I wait, and then I get a ping, and it's done it. So it's pretty quick. It's quite impressive. It's quite useful. I quite enjoy using it, but I am still very cautious about what I give it access to.
Yeah. And you're talking about it sort of doing things whilst you're busy or asleep or whatever. Have you got any routine scheduled things that it does every night that are just standard scheduled things that you always want to have done?
So it wakes up every... The thing I mentioned earlier, I said it checks a file, like a to-do list or something. I've also got it waking up every 2 hours just to do an update me. And all it says to me in Telegram, if I scroll back through my Telegram, every 2 hours for the last, I don't know, 8 hours, it just says nothing new. It's just acknowledging I have woken up. It's like a cron job, waking up and saying I've got nothing new to do. So I know it hasn't done anything for the last 8 hours because there's been nothing in its list. But earlier on, at about 11 o'clock, it mentioned a couple of CI jobs that still need my acknowledgement. And it hasn't kept pinging me about them. It pinged me once at 11 o'clock this morning, and there's nothing new since then. So if I scroll back through my Telegram conversation, I've got like two blocks of, here's some things you really need to look at because it needs my approval. But it hasn't actively gone out and done anything because I haven't put anything in its to-do list. So I'm trying to like add things bit by bit. I think I would like to add a few things, like go and have a look at anything that's got Dependabot on it. Go and have a look for, you know, new things to do here. Go and have a look for new things to do there. But I'm very cautious and conservative about this because I don't want it to go on a rampage and suddenly find a bunch of stuff to do and commit a whole bunch of pull requests somewhere and then me look like an idiot. And I'm partly trying to prevent myself looking like an idiot by keeping it as a separate GitHub account. But it does say in the profile, it is an AI assistant managed by me. So, I'm not trying to hide from the fact that I'm using it. I just want it to be not have full access. So it doesn't have access to all my work stuff at all because it doesn't have access to those repositories and so on because it's a separate GitHub account and it's not in any of those orgs. But yes, I would like to add some to-do lists, and maybe once I do that, I'll report back. But at the moment, it's running on my home server, so it's limited by the capabilities of a home server, and it's also inside a LexD container, so it's limited by what it can see. Mm-hmm. And I know some of the horror stories online of people using Claude and it doing crazy things, but I'm being very conservative, and I'm trying not to let it rampage.